Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the widening political scandal in New Jersey following accusations by the mayor of Hoboken that the Christie administration tied FEMA disaster money from Hurricane Sandy to a development project they favored. Ryan Hutchins, who covers state government and politics in New Jersey for the Star Ledger, joins us to discuss his interview with Mayor Dawn Zimmer following her meeting with federal prosecutors who interviewed her on Sunday. Then on this Martin Luther King holiday, we will speak with Jared Ball, an associate professor of communication studies at Morgan State University, about the intense surveillance Dr. King was under from the FBI, military intelligence, and the CIA, with at least 25 illegal attempts by the FBI to discredit him. We'll discuss the surveillance state then that has since been reformed and the surveillance state today that has much greater capabilities and is able to gather private information on all Americans. Then finally, we will speak with Chris Parker, a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington and author of Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. We'll discuss the political legacy of Martin Luther King at a time when America has its first black president and also a Supreme Court who recently gutted the Voting Rights Act that Dr. King had fought and died for. Joining us now is Ryan Hutchins, who covers state government and politics in New Jersey for the Star Ledger. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ryan Hutchins.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And over the weekend, Hoboken Mayor Dawn Zimmer met with federal prosecutors after she had gone on MSNBC and said that the lieutenant governor in the Christie administration had basically leaned on her that she'd get the FEMA money for disaster aid from Hurricane Sandy if she played ball on a development project involving the Rockefeller Group. What's your understanding of the nature of those meetings? Who showed up from the U.S. Attorney's Office, and what evidence did she provide them?
Well, she was pretty mum on it when we talked to her yesterday. She sent out a statement indicating that she sat down for a few hours. She told us later that it was roughly 3 hours that they talked. They met at their offices in Newark, just down the street from where I am today. And who exactly was in the room, she didn't want to disclose, but we could suspect some assistant prosecutors at least, and maybe some investigators and others. It's unclear whether U.S. Attorney Paul Fishman was there. He recently announced a review of allegations involving the George Washington Bridge scandal you've probably heard about over there, and the Christie administration's involvement in that. But that's just a review. It's not an investigation. And the U.S. Attorney's Office yesterday, a spokeswoman for them, wouldn't indicate whether or not this meeting ever took place, which is their pretty much standard operating procedure there.
So what's the sense in New Jersey about this popular governor? I mean, the Bridgegate thing, I think, was pretty shocking to a lot of people, people who are trying to be objective, who may be both Democrats and Republicans. Obviously, he is a popular Republican in a heavily Democratic state. But there was something sort of basically easy to understand about it, which is a traffic study to close down the most important artery into New York between New York and New Jersey. It made no sense. The whole thing looked so obviously on the surface as political retribution. But since then, there's been this drip, drip, drip. So do you think he's getting out ahead of this?
Well, they're certainly trying, but I think if this past weekend was really any indication, it's not easy. Like you said, it's kind of this continuing thing. They try and make some strides ahead to get past it. He held his State of the State speech last week, laying out, his plan for the next year and for his second term in office. It all just continues with talk of the bridge thing. There were subpoenas last week, 20 subpoenas sent out, 17 to actual people, compelling them to produce documents. A lot of these are some of his top people in his administration, in his office, a really tight-knit crew he has working for them. And it just keeps on continuing now with these accusations about this development project and Hurricane Sandy funding. He was in Florida this weekend in his role with the Republican Governors Association, heading that up, trying to drum up some money down there. And he basically had to slip through back doors and get ushered away quickly in his black SUV to avoid a whole lot of reporters and cameras who'd made it down there to try and get just a single word with him. So it's dogging him, that's for sure. You can call him an embattled governor.
And Ryan Hutchins, again, who covers state government and politics in New Jersey for the Star Ledger, you mentioned the Port Authority official David Weilstein and subpoenas. He, of course, was very close to Christie, was he not? Don't they go back to high school, those two?
Yeah, that's right. They knew each other in high school and were, you know, friends of some sort. I think it's a little unclear on exactly how close they were, but you know, certainly high school friends, acquaintances. He's been involved in politics for quite some time, Weilstein. He was he ran a politics blog here, Politicker NJ, as a, you know, had a pseudonym. Nobody was quite sure for a while who was running it, and it was him. And he's kind of been involved in a lot of shadowy political things like that since. And then in this instance, he was appointed to head up these kind of interstate projects between you know, for the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. It's a bi-state agency with a board appointed by both the governors of New York and New Jersey. And in that role, we're not entirely sure what he did because he doesn't have a job description. So obviously a political appointment, and some say it was just really a link between the governor's office and the Port Authority. But he's the one who actually ordered these lane closures, access lanes leading to the George Washington Bridge in Fort Lee, New Jersey. And he's kind of at the center of all this. When he was called to testify recently before a legislative committee investigating the matter, he took the Fifth. And so we don't really know everything he knows, but his lawyer tells us he knows quite a bit more.
Well, that would be what might be giving Governor Christie sleepless nights, right? We know how federal prosecutors operate. You know, they basically say, you're going to spend, you know, a decade or so in jail unless you give us information on the higher-ups. I mean, that's standard operating procedure, is it? Is that what's going on now?
Well, if we're to believe the governor, he's probably not too worried about it because he says he doesn't know anything else. He says that, you know, he first learned about this all in the media, and he was shocked and appalled when he learned that his deputy chief of staff was involved in ordering these lane closures. He had no idea, he said, and within a day of learning, he said he fired her. But you're right. So the U.S. attorney, Paul Fishman, has his people reviewing this, and they'll probably move slow and methodically. And that is a lot of what they do. They get convinced people, they get leverage over them, and try and get them to tell their story. Now, Weilstein's attorney, he says that he'll only talk if he has immunity from federal prosecutors in the state of New Jersey and in the state of New York. So that's certainly something difficult to do. And what exactly he can tell us, we have no idea. He's just being very vague and saying that he's got a story to tell.
Well, but that looks like a kind of smoking gun, doesn't it? I mean, if he wants immunity, he's going to have to deliver. And it sounds like he thinks he's got enough to deliver on to get immunity.
Right, it does sound that way. You know, his attorney has been setting that up. He put out the call for that publicly when Weilstein was called to testify before this state assembly committee when he took the Fifth in this kind of, you know, famous stare down, where he wouldn't even say whether something that was on the screen that he'd produced in response to a subpoena was an email or not. Pleaded the fifth on all of those, but he insists there's something that people want to know. Certainly, prosecutors would want to have some sense of what they're going to get, what they're going to know, and what he's going to testify to before they sign any deals like that.
Well, just in closing, going back to Dawn Zimmer, the mayor of Hoboken, who appeared on MSNBC early in the weekend and dropped this bombshell that she was both pressured by the lieutenant governor in the Christie administration and by the head of the
Department of Community Affairs.
Department of Community Affairs, yeah. Constable, himself a former federal prosecutor. And this has led to federal prosecutors interviewing Dawn Zimmer over the weekend. How do you, though, separate out the business as usual in politics, where he who controls the purse strings has leverage? So the fact that the governor had made such a public display with Barack Obama, which of course upset a lot of the Republicans, including their presidential candidate, Mitt Romney, days before the election. There he was seen with the Darth Vader, as far as a lot of Republicans are concerned, Barack Obama. And he obviously was instrumental in probably getting a lot of that FEMA money, but he also controlled how it was spent. So that's sort of normal, isn't it, that you basically, if you got the money, you can hand out the treats. But this is somewhat different, is it not, though, in terms of the development project and the sort of implication of fairly naked blackmail, which again ties into the bridge story about political retribution.
Right. I think for a lot of the things you laid out there, especially the idea that this is money for Hurricane Sandy, you know, one of the worst storms in a whole long time to hit the Northeast. Dozens of people died, you know, as a result of this storm, and it also at the same time built Chris Christie up to have this national image as a unassailable leader who could do no wrong, at least as a governor, as a leader, maybe not politically, as some Republicans like Mitt Romney felt, but it's so that's part of it. It's kind of chipping away that armor of the face of Hurricane Sandy recovery, if it's true. And then also, right, the idea about this development project, not necessarily a quid pro quo like you might think of Jersey politics, how things get done, you know. He holds the purse strings, holds all the power. But like you said, the accusation is that they've really held this over them, held this over the mayor, and said that, you know, if she didn't approve this this development project in the way they wanted, kind of set it up to be fast-tracked, they wouldn't get this money. We're still looking into whether they did get, a reasonable amount of money compared to some other towns. We're taking a look at that today and trying to figure that out. But that's her accusation, and it's certainly going to be something we're going to be talking about for quite a while now.
Well, she, so far, claims they only got $142,000 and asked for $100 million.
Yeah, I mean, she asked for $100 million out of what's, coming out of about $300 million that they had, and there were billions of dollars in requests from mayors around the state. So she certainly wasn't going to get anywhere near the $100 million. But, there's other money that was involved. There's a lot of different types of funding and some money that the state could control, that the Christie administration control, and some that they couldn't. So we're still trying to drill down and see what's really the case.
Well, I appreciate your time with us here today, Ryan Hutchinson. Thank you so much.
Thank you a lot, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Ryan Hutchinson, who covers state government and politics in New Jersey for the Star-Ledger. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the FBI, military intelligence, and CIA surveillance of Dr. Martin Luther King. Let me rip my legs.
on your mighty rims and relieve your stressful condition. You got Wall Street master stuck cheek to cheek with blue collar truckers, and man, I really gotta take a leak, but I can't. I'm stuck.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jared Ball, who's an Associate Professor of Communication Studies at Morgan State University and the author of I Mix What I Like, A Mixtape Manifesto, as well as co-editor of A Lie of Reinvention, Correcting Manny Marable's Malcolm X. He can be found online at imixwhatilike.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jared Ball.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And on this Martin Luther King Day, it's worth, I think, and important to address the pretty much what's in the news here today, given the president's speech last Friday, how much our secret police, our secret state, our surveillance state is alive and well, much more so than it was during Martin Luther King's day. But Martin Luther King, I think, stands as an example of the kind of abuse of a police state that was common in East Germany with the Stasi and very powerfully portrayed in that movie, The Lives of Others. Do you think that the experience of Martin Luther King has been forgotten in America?
Well, in some ways, it's not that it's just been forgotten. It's that it's never been told. We live in the United States, I think, with broadly speaking, within the most highly propagandized media environment that the world has ever seen. And part of that process, part of what has emerged as a result of that, developing that as part of a process, is a real historical amnesia, or worse, never knowing. That many of us have never entered a state of really knowing, in this case, who Dr. King was, what his politics really were, particularly as they were evolving towards the end of his life. And then, of course, we don't know what the state's response to him was. So many in this country, as I've argued for some years now, I think Dr. King is the most known and least understood figure in human history, actually, maybe second only to the historical Jesus Christ. And as a result, so many people are aware of him by name and obviously associated with this I Have a Dream phrase, not even the full speech there. And don't really know where he went beyond that and what the state's response. So very few people are aware that at the end of his life, all the major media in this country, all the major political elite in this country, all of the civil rights elite leadership in this country had either distanced themselves or fully gone into attack mode against Dr. King. So that by the day that he was assassinated on April 4th, 1968, Dr. King was under surveillance by the FBI and its counterintelligence program. He was under surveillance by military intelligence, by the CIA, by undercover Memphis police, and more. And all because of the stances that he was starting to take politically, anti-Vietnam, anti-war, anti-capitalism, non-aligned movement alignment, so to speak, pro-labor, anti-white supremacy. He had become an enormous critic of the black bourgeoisie and of white liberals in particular as not doing their part to advance the struggle. He was critical of the civil rights legislation that was being passed and the Voting Rights Act as being insufficient and not addressing, all of the concerns that result from a structural inequality as a result primarily of the capitalist economy. And he was looking to develop strategies to really draw attention to and to strike at the heart of these issues. So he had become, by the end of his life, as even reported in the pages of the Washington Post, a threat to national security, and as we unfortunately saw, he was dealt with as such.
Again, I'm speaking with Jared Ball, an associate professor of communication studies at Morgan State University and the author of I Mix What I Like, a Mixtape Manifesto, as well as co-editor of A Lie of Reinvention, Correcting Manny Marable's Malcolm X. He can be found online at imixwhatilike.org. But just to give some context, Jared, to the April 4th assassination in Memphis in 1968 of Martin Luther King, he had previously been in Memphis and led a demonstration that turned violent, largely because of FBI provocateurs. And the FBI then put out, fed to the media, because Martin Luther King was whisked away from this demonstration. It was one of the lowest points in his life, because here he was, a champion of nonviolence, leading a demonstration that ended up with windows being smashed and looting, etc. So he was whisked away out of this demonstration, and then the FBI then put out to the press that he ran like a rabbit, etc. And as you just pointed out, the surveillance of him was ubiquitous, and that's the whole point of what a police state and this police state mechanism can do to an individual. They have the ability to write their own script, and you are merely an actor in your own life if they control you in the way that they control Martin Luther King, surely.
Absolutely. And again, as others have tried to point out, as I've in some minimal way tried to point out, the surveillance that Dr. King suffered was merely an extension of the kinds of surveillance that people that preceded him in this liberation struggle have suffered, that people in all really oppressed conditions have suffered. Certainly in this country, since the advent of enslavement, African people have been under surveillance of all forms by the state and other friendly entities from the beginning. So this was merely his turn, so to speak, in taking that center stage as this actor, as you described, or at least with an attempt there to manipulate him, to manage his behavior, to control what ultimately would be his behavior. And this is why the FBI encouraged him through letter writing to kill himself. They threatened to expose his infidelity. They threatened to, as you said, to further this myth of him as a coward. And even as I said, in the pages of the most popular newspapers in this country, they were depicting him as someone who was, by the end of his life, losing control over the movement and succumbing to communists and Leninists and black powerites, and repositioning him as somebody who could not be taken seriously, who was now outside of the established acceptable civil rights leadership. And this is why they were saying after his anti-Vietnam speech, or his most famous one at Riverside Church in 1967, they did the popular press, the Washington Post and Time Magazine and Newsweek, described him as having lost his relevancy, as having lost his bearings, as having basically given a speech that Hanoi would have found suitable, and were looking to, again, to discredit him, to weaken the impact that he was actually having on the movement, which was taking, again, his part in a line or in a collective of people who had preceded him in this way, to be critical of the economic system, to be critical of the militarism, to link the civil rights movement here to the human rights and liberation struggles of black and brown people all around the world. This was exactly what those in power had happily seen him not do earlier in his career and look to expand upon. And this is why I think it's also interesting, given the way Dr. King is depicted today, for people to realize or to learn about or investigate the ways in which, as some researchers before me have pointed out, that up until 1965, the popular press in this country loved Dr. King and loved, in particular, to use him as a counterposing figure to against people like Malcolm X and people like Robert Williams and people engaged in more aggressive and radical forms of political struggle. But by 1966, Dr. King had, through his own experiences in Chicago and elsewhere, begun to amend his policy, amend his political trajectory to adopt these more radical positions, and the press took suit in attacking him and looking to again do to others what do to King what had been done to others, that is to set him in opposition to other more acceptable forms of leadership, so that by the end he was quite literally in the sense of the balcony, but figuratively in the sense of popular media, left to stand alone and suffer the consequences of those positions. And since his assassination, while the conditions of black people have steadily declined rather than improved, the mythology has gone in quite the opposite direction, which has necessitated an attendant mythology of Dr. King as being someone who would have been happy with the progress, so-called, that we've made since his assassination, when I think it's quite obvious that the opposite is true.
And, Jared Ball, recently the people who broke into the FBI office in Philadelphia, or outside of Philadelphia, that revealed the COINTELPRO operation, amongst many documents that they got from this FBI field office in Media, Pennsylvania. That couple recently was surfaced on 60 Minutes in a book that's been written about them. That, of course, led to hearings of the Church Committee, which both brought about FBI reforms and CIA reforms in the form of the two oversight committees on the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, etc. But I find it pretty extraordinary that as the sort of wheel turns, if you will, here we are talking about an NSA that has infinitely more capability than anybody had back in the Church Committee days, and is not just surveilling African Americans, they're surveilling everybody. We're all caught up in this metadata as though we're all guilty until proven innocent.
Well, that's right. And the small point I've tried to make about that is that this is the logical conclusion of the incompleteness of a movement that was symbolized and in some cases led by Dr. King. So what we saw happening to King and many others in that movement and many people before that discovery in Media, Pennsylvania had been saying, look, there's something going on here. There's some sort of government involvement in disrupting our movements. And many of them were chastised for having even considering that such a thing was possible, only to discover that not only was it possible, that it was much more deeply involved and pervasive than anyone could have imagined. So just as the letter writing campaign looked to falsely describe King as someone who was a traitor to certain ideals of the movement, or someone who was engaged in all kinds of infidelity, cheating on Coretta, or as someone who, as the FBI in their own letter writing campaign, tried to convince King himself to kill himself. These kinds of endeavors were more extensive than, beyond Dr. King himself, but they've become far more pervasive and extended beyond the so-called political battlefield to, as you said, to incorporate all of us, even those of us who are not currently engaged in any sort of consciously political activism or struggle against the powers that be. But this is what is, of course, as I mentioned a moment ago, if we look at just what has not improved in terms of the conditions, not only of black people, but of working people and many other groups of people in this country and around the world, there would have to be an increased level of surveillance, because there is an increased level of oppression that is being delivered and meted out upon all of these different communities. So much more has to be done. And with the advances, so-called, in technology, why not put those to good use? Because it is predictable that people who are being oppressed will use the media technology available to them to struggle against that oppression. So why not use that technology, as has always been, to spy on, to limit and mitigate any of the efforts that those people in struggle might take up, or the people who might potentially take up should they even ever discover what is actually happening here. So I think that it's the logical conclusion that that's what we would see, and this is what I think is important about this kind of history. By the way, the good folks at the Freedom Archives, who developed a couple of years ago this wonderful documentary about the counterintelligence program called COINTELPRO 101, what this documentary points out in introducing people to this history is that what was done illegally by the FBI under that COINTELPRO is now perfectly legal under the Patriot Act, which has itself been extended and buttressed by the current president, Barack Obama. So what is being done, what Edward Snowden was looking to make known to more people, that was actually done illegally at the time of Dr. King, is now perfectly legal and that much more pervasive. And as you mentioned, has caught all of us up in its nets.
Again, I'm speaking with Jared Ball, an associate professor of communication studies at Morgan State University and the author of I Mix What I Like, a mixtape manifesto, as well as co-editor of A Lie of Reinvention, Correcting Manny Marable's Malcolm X. He can be found online at imixwhatilike.org. Well, the fact that at the National Security Agency, those who do the work of surveilling foreign targets and domestic targets, apparently they is sort of an inside joke that they have a program called LoveInt. That's a play on the word SIGINT, which is an intelligence abbreviation for signals intelligence. And LoveInt involves NSA operatives like Snowden was, although he was a contractor, basically snooping into their girlfriends or their wives or their friends' computers and phones and faxes and emails and tweets and you name it, to find out whether they're cheating on each other or whatever. And that's the sort of inside joke. So when I learned about that, I thought to myself, well, if they have the ability to do that as a kind of prank, we already have the infrastructure laid down for us for a surveillance state, a police state. And so it all comes down to the idea that, as the president is basically trying to sell us as well, that we just have to trust. It's all about trust, that they'll do the right thing. They have the ability to do what the government did to Martin Luther King, but don't worry about it because we're going to do the right thing and we only care about foreign terrorists. Do you find that reassuring?
Well, not at all. I mean, if we just look at the conditions again, if we just use the conditions that people suffer as evidence of the will of the institutions that govern our lives, I think we'll see that that statement can't be taken seriously, that perspective at least can't be taken seriously. So if I'm just looking here at the Economic Policy Institute website, a piece written by Algernon Alston about what has not happened since Dr. King's, since the March on Washington in 1963, just a few points I think will easily challenge that perspective. That is that in 1963, there was a concern at the March on Washington about the slum-like conditions that many black people had to suffer, and today half of poor black children live in concentrated poverty. In the late 1960s, 76% of black children attended segregated schools. In 2010, 74% of black children attend mostly still segregated schools. And on it goes. The whether it's long-term unemployment, which is for black America the highest it's been since 1948, whether it's been the gap between how much white and black people are paid at their jobs, all of these things speak to, never mind mass incarceration, continued political imprisonment, and so many other things. If we just look at some of these key indicators and see just what has not improved, we can see very clearly that the apparatus, the structure that led to all the conditions that against which Dr. King sought to struggle, still exists today, and in some cases are actually worse. So if you want to have those kinds of conditions and you want to prevent what was the quite natural response of the civil rights movement from ever happening again, or you want to weaken what has started to occur with the Occupy movement, or you want to weaken what would have what would extend from any number of forms of struggling liberation styled movements, labor movements, etc., you would have to increase your surveillance. You would have to increase the pervasiveness of your surveillance, and then, of course, create the mythology around it that it is, as you were saying, all for the good. And to the extent that this is successful, it will protect those in power from having to deal again with a movement that produced King. And I think it's always important to remember that it was a movement that produced Dr. King, not the other way around. And if we want more Dr. Kings, we have to reorganize a social political movement that will produce that kind of leadership. And that's exactly what the counterintelligence program papers in 1966 said specifically they wanted to do, prevent the rise of a black messiah. They said that they targeted Dr. King as a potential threat should he, as they said, forego his obedience to white liberal doctrine and nonviolence and embrace black nationalism. And as he began to evolve and radicalize his own politics, he became more of a threat. And this is exactly what we could expect to occur again today. And that's why I think that there are direct links to be made between the surveillance suffered by Dr. King and those involved in that kind of struggle then, and the kind of surveillance that we're seeing now that involves a surveillance of people not even consciously involved in any kind of particular political movement, but who are potential members of a threatening political movement, given the conditions that continue to worsen.
Well, it seems to me, though, Jared Ball, that in many ways what's happening in this country is a kind of atavistic reactionary effort to keep racism alive. And it's largely, I think, a tactic of the Republican Party, who are, as we speak, conducting a war on the poor. They've cut food stamps, they've cut unemployment benefits. Their friends on the Supreme Court, the five conservatives, recently struck down important provisions of the Voting Rights Act. The subtext that they send out to the endangered white man, the working class white men in this country who'd vote against their interests and vote for the Republican Party, all of those fears are stoked and stacked by the subtext of much of what is, in fact, the propaganda within the Republican Party. In other words, my sense is that poor white people and poor black people have much more in common than they realize, and that the tactic is to divide them as opposed to allow them to unite around a common goal. Now, that's not to say that African Americans are uniquely being targeted and punished in this country with mass incarceration of black men, which is extraordinary and appalling reality. But just to my point about racism being a weapon to divide as opposed to allow people to recognize how much they have in common, do you accept that thesis?
Well, to a certain extent, I do. But what I think is the beauty of Dr. King's analysis as it evolved is that he became, and this is what I think added to the level of what was his threat, was that he became extremely critical, not just of Republicans and white conservatives, but of the Democrats and white liberals. And this is something that I think is largely lost in this discussion of the role race plays in dividing people and allowing for a tiny minority to rule all of us. And that as Dr. King himself said, and this is why I always encourage people to go back and read his last book, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, where he explains very clearly that it's the liberals that he is most offended by, that it is the white liberals, as he said, that walked off with the aggressors once they got past the surface level changes of an anti-segregation movement. But when it got to the real core issues of the economy, of distribution of wealth and goods and services, of the treatment of black people, of the consciousness of surrounding black self-love and black collective development, that's where he became. That's what I find it most, you know, partly at least, what is most compelling about revisiting his work, because it is today, it is the Democratic Party that is as much guilty and as much complicit in the lap of progress as anybody else. And it's easy to blame the Republicans. It's easy to blame the conservatives. But, you know, just for instance, I mean, it was Bill Clinton that attacked welfare, that expanded the prison industrial complex, that expanded the military. And just as it's Obama that has expanded the military beyond that of even George Bush, that has extended the drone strike warfare, the militarization of the African continent with AFRICOM, that has given more to Wall Street than any other president before him, that has denied in his public statements chastising black people the role of entrenched white supremacy, structural racism plays in denying black people the ability to sustain and develop and build a better lives and communities. So it's that I think is important to remember here as we reflect on Dr. King and where we are today. That as many others, as Malcolm X and Kwame Ture and others have pointed out, Dr. King too had become a vociferous critic of white liberals and of course the black bourgeoisie as not playing their role in this struggle. And he said, in fact, that white people had not something to the effect collectively psychologically organized themselves to deal with black people on a level of true equality. And I think that still plagues us today. So we'll get the symbolic political crumb of a Barack Obama. But when it comes to really addressing the structural inequalities that do specifically target black working people, we get very little of that. We get, in fact, we get quite the opposite. We get calls from the black president to be better fathers and to return to our bootstrap mentality. The same Barack Obama who would tell African leaders, as he did in Ghana some years ago, that the problems they face have nothing to do with European colonialism and imperialism, but have everything to do with black corrupt leadership. This is the kind of thing that we get from the left that I think that Dr. King was calling for us to pay attention to and to struggle against, and I think needs a mighty struggle against today.
Well, Jared Bolla, thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jared Ball, who's an associate professor of communication studies at Morgan State University and author of I Mix What I Like, A Mixtape Manifesto, as well as co-editor of A Lie of Reinvention, Correcting Manny Marable's Malcolm X. He can be found online at imixwhatilike.org. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the political legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Black and green instead of gang bandanas, FBI spying on us through the radio antennas, and them hitting cameras in the street like watching society with no respect for the people's right to privacy. I want to be free to live, able to have what I need to live, bring the power back to the street where the people live. We sick of working for crumbs and filling up the prisons, dying over money and relying on religion for help. Can you relate? We living in a police.
No more bondage, no more political monsters, no more secrets.
Born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain, as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in our game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Chris Parker, Professor of Social Justice and Political Science at the University of Washington. He's the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics and the director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington, and author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book is Change They Can't Believe in, the Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Parker.
I'm happy to be back, and Happy New Year to you, albeit belated.
And happy Martin Luther King Day, I guess, since we're speaking on Martin Luther King Day. And
tell
me, what's your sense then of the legacy of Martin Luther King, in the political legacy in particular, in the context of the United States having its first black president, but at the same time, the Supreme Court recently gutted the Voting Rights Act that Dr. King fought and died for?
Well, so let me take the last question first. So I think the Voting Rights Act, you know, gutting Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, 1965, I think that was obviously a step backwards because it's really going to, I guess, bail out some of the states, quote-unquote bail out, that is to say, states that would have to pre-clear any changes to the voting laws in particular states. They are no longer held accountable. Now, having said that, and that was a huge blow, but having said that, there's a recent push for legislation, a bipartisan push for legislation to work around it, to effect a workaround on, you know, the gutting of Section 4. So there is some hope that we can find a way around this in the not-so-distant future, and it can be done so, you know, through the small-d Democratic process. And I think that the courts would be loath to go back and try to redo that if it's done through the Democratic process again. So I would say that, so to answer your first question, I would say that having the first African-American president, I mean, I think that can be, you know, significantly attributed to Dr. King and the cause for which he fought. And I think that, I mean, even if he's governing as a, you know, center-right or more to the right than some people would like, I mean, the fact of the matter is that we do have our first African-American president, and so that does mean a lot to a lot of people, not only in the United States, but around the world as well.
Well, Chris Parker, our previous guest was suggesting that towards the end of his life, Martin Luther King was more angry at white liberals and the black bourgeoisie than anybody else. Is that your recollection?
No, it's not. So if I understand this correctly, so in his letter from a Birmingham jail in 1963, he was angry at white moderates. I don't recall anything about white liberals at all. Now, it could be the case, and I've read quite a bit about Dr. King. That's part of what I do is black politics. I don't remember anything, you know, saying that he was upset at white liberals. White moderates, yes, because he thought it was a white moderates, especially in the South, because we're talking about 1963 in the South, that white moderates were, you know, permitting, if we could only get white moderates, he thought, on our side, then it would make our job a little easier in fighting for basic civil rights in the South. Now, this stuff on white liberals is very new to me. Now, as far as the black bourgeoisie, he was part of the black bourgeoisie, which is not to say that he, you know, could not be angry or disappointed with the black bourgeoisie, but I have no recollection at all, and I don't think I've ever read that anyplace, that he was angry at the black bourgeoisie.
Well, how would he be feeling today, though, given the mass incarceration of young black men?
Well, I mean, so his last campaign, or the campaign that he, on which he had embarked prior to his untimely departure from this world, was based on, it wasn't necessarily based on race. It was mainly based on class, the Poor People's Campaign. Now, we all know that race and class are really tightly linked empirically. So I guess I would say that, yeah, he would really feel upset about, you know, the extent to which black and brown people have been incarcerated vis-a-vis white men of comparable age and class. So it's no doubt about that. He would certainly be disappointed because there is a stigma that is associated with incarceration. It's been shown empirically time and time again that black men who have the same record as some white men, they have a much harder time finding employment opportunities than do similarly situated white men.
So, again, I'm speaking with Chris Parker, professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He's the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics and director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington and author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book is Change They Can't Believe in, the Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. And just going from your latest book, Chris Parker, my sense is, and in fact I spoke with Jared Ball, the previous guest, about this, is about how the Tea Party and the reactionary right have, in fact, arguably the Republican Party is using racism as a way to kind of bond, if you will, their base and motivate their base. That the moment there's obviously a war on the poor with the cut in food stamps and the unemployment benefits. And, you know, the point I was trying to make is that it seems to me that poor whites and poor blacks in this country have more in common than they have in terms of what separates them. But it seems to me that race is being used as a way to keep people thinking about class issues. And arguably, what we should be discussing is the extent to which we live in an oligarchy, not a democracy, and that our economy is a plutonomy.
Oh, I mean, yeah, Ian, I think you're spot on with that analysis. I think your analysis is right on point in that. I mean, we saw the same thing, you know, in close to the close of the 19th century and the early 20th century with the populist movement, where you had whites essentially use race to separate, you know, the black farmers from the white farmers in a populist movement. So, you know, we've seen this time and time and time again, you know, historically in the United States, that class is generally subordinated to race. Think about in a Jim Crow South in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. I mean, you had blacks and whites, poor blacks and whites that had, you know, class interests, you know, were aligned with each other, but race was used as a trump card to keep poor blacks and poor whites, the working class whites and working class blacks apart. And so we're seeing the same thing now where you're having race that mobilizes, you know, these, you know, working class and poor whites, you know, politically to vote essentially against their economic self-interest. So it's no question about that. That is happening right now. And this is not the first time we've seen this happen, as I've alluded to just a moment ago. And this certainly won't be the last time we see this happen.
So what's your sense then of the generation of politicians, African-American politicians that have succeeded the civil rights movement? We still have John Lewis, who's still a great fighter in the Congress. My friend Don Payne died some time back. I don't get the feeling that the mantle of Dr. King is necessarily being taken to new heights.
Now, if what you're referring to is this sort of civil rights genre in which, you know, social justice is at the top of the list, and I think your assessment is correct once again. I think that the sort of quote-unquote new black politicians, you know, they're playing more mainstream politics. They're, instead of emphasizing race per se, what they're trying to do is they're trying to come at it, you know, in terms of class, which I think is a smart strategy, because once race is introduced, then what's going to happen is it's going to turn off, you know, those voters, mainly white voters, who are going to welcome class issues more, because when it comes down to race, they, you know, what the empirical literature has shown is that as soon as race is involved, or as soon as race is injected into the conversation, what happens is that turns them off to any sort of redistributive measures that would have been taken otherwise, or any redistributive policies, rather, that would have been undertaken otherwise. If they're more likely to react in a positive way if it's framed as a class issue versus a race issue, because it seems if it's a race issue, it's a zero-sum game. That's the way that they see this.
Well, I must say that lately watching these television award shows, you know, here I am broadcasting from Hollywood or North Hollywood across the street from Universal Studios. So many of these shows are, you know, the awards season is on now in Los Angeles. And, you know, you turn on the television, it's just replete with celebrity worship. And I'm beginning to wonder whether celebrity worship, and let's face it, a lot of celebrities now are African-American, and certainly in sports. So I guess what I'm suggesting here is that it seems to me, economically speaking, we are entering a new feudalism. I mean, even one of the richest men in the country said a while back that we are in danger of becoming a plantation economy. So it seems to me that there is a kind of new feudalism underway with the war on the poor, the war on unions. At the same time, to quote Marx, the celebrity has become the new opiate of the masses.
The point is well taken, that religion is the opiate of the masses. And just to flesh that out a little further, as far as I understand the argument, it's the opiate of the masses because it puts their demands for change off, you know, until they die and they are reborn into a new life, and they go to heaven and things will all be better, right? So right now, you know, their wants and desires and interests are put off until the afterlife. And so it makes it easier, as far as I understand this, you know, for the upper classes or the ruling classes to lower it over the lower classes, because religion is placating them, the lower classes. So that's just to fully flesh that out for your listeners. Now, moving forward, so celebrity is the opiate for the underclasses when it comes to their, as far as I understand you saying this, is that it permits them to dream that, you know, maybe one day, you know, this can happen to me, or you making a reference to this is like pablum for them. They can just watch this and marinate in this and the celebrity worship. So therefore it will preclude them from taking any social action. Which one of these are you referring to?
I would say both are true, at least to my mind. And given the widening disparity in wealth in this country, where the poor are getting poorer and fewer of the rich are getting richer, it would seem to me that celebrity is in fact being peddled now as a way to, you know, maintain the delusion that we still have an American dream and that you know that you can make it. You know, the old Horatio Alger myth.
Yes. The whole Horatio. Yeah. If you work hard and you work hard, you do the right thing, then one can make it in life. And I think that's part of the sort of American dream, or that's part of the American creed: hard work and diligence, or just maintaining the Protestant work ethic or adhering to that, you know, will permit one to make it in life. And that's been part of the American creed from the very beginning, and it continues to be the case, as public opinion data will reflect. But I think let's qualify this celebrity as an opiate for the masses. I mean, it's mainly an age and class thing, because I think that people that are older, let's say, you know, 40 and older, they're not really buying into this, because for them, you know, what are they going to be? They're going to be a basketball player, or they're going to be a football player? They're going to be a rap star at that age? Probably not. So we're talking about people who were younger and people who were, you know, working class or poor, who have those sort of aspirations because they think it's still possible for them. So I just wanted to make sure, you know, that we were, you know, that we, you know, we honed in on, you know, the groups to which this is relevant. It's the younger, you know, more working class or poor folks, you know, who have these aspirations, who have these hopes, and for which, you know, maybe celebrity does serve as an opiate.
Well, Chris Parker, I really appreciate you joining us here today on Martin Luther King Day and our conversation.
All right. Thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me back.
Again, I've been speaking with Chris Parker. He's a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He is the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics, director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington, and author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. His latest book just out is Change They Can't Believe In, the Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.